Welcome to Protecting Project Pulp, part of the District of Wonders Network, featuring Starship Sofa, Tales to Terrify, and Crime City Central. Everyone has a story in the District of Wonders. Come and find yours.
This is Protecting Project Pulp, episode 65. I'm your host, Simon Hildebrandt. Welcome to the show. This week we bring you The Island Trovar by J.C. Hemphill, narrated by Adam Pratch. According to his biography, J.C. Hemphill was born yesterday, so if you find his writing infantile, you're spot on. But you got to admit, he's pretty damn good for a toddler. His work has appeared in the Washington Pastime, Pulp Modern, SNM Horror Magazine, Stories in the Ether, Bonded by Blood 4 Best of 2011, and Spine Tinglers, with upcoming work in Buzzy Mag, Zombie Tales, and Cover of Darkness. He lives in Cumming, GA, with his wonderful wife and a pair of layabout dogs. Outside of writing, he is a cook with the rowdiest assisted living centre in the South and is working towards a degree in creative writing. Follow his scribblings on Facebook or at jchemphill.com. Our narrator, Adam Pratch, is a writer, editor, and sometime narrator living in Kansas. He works full-time as the on-staff writer and editor for McPherson College, where he writes news releases, the alumni magazine, and other publications, as well as generally making a nuisance of himself, correcting obscure grammar rules wherever he finds them. He's also assistant editor at Starship Sofa, securing stories and narrators for the fiction element of the show, and is also the creator of the monthly Cheapskate segment, giving reviews of free science fiction ebooks and audiobooks, as well as spouting off about anything else he wants to talk about. He is the author of Frame Story, Seven Tales of Sci-Fi and Fantasy, Horror and Humor, and he is working on his second book, Schrodinger's Zombie, Seven Weird and Wonderful Tales of the Undead, which draws inspiration from Schrodinger's Cat, pulp detective novels, soulmates, brain transplants, medieval revenants, Frankenstein, and of course, mermaids. So make no bones about it, it's time to explore The Island Trovar by J.C. Hemphill, narrated by Adam Pratch.
The mast of our ship pierced the low-lying clouds that had shrouded our vision for an hour or more, and the sea opened before us like an indigo field waving in the wind. A general whoop went around the ship at the sight of our destination. The Island Trovar. It was as beautiful and mysterious and chilling as the rumors had said. More so, even. A black crag protruded from the sea like the jagged remains of a seaman's half-rotted tooth, giving way to sloping land that grated into the ocean, where the mountain grew to leviathan proportions. Beneath the tropical waters, where even light dared not delve, Trovar hid its molten, beating heart. The leeward side of the island was rough with black cliffs and sprays of white foam, as waves crashed upon the rocks with deadly force. The windward side was a stark contrast of lush jungle edging a serene bay. The idea was inexplicable, but I could sense a dark presence hiding in those thick tangles of wilderness. Something with eyes. Beady, ignorant, ravenous eyes. "You put any stock in the native's lore," Herb Flenderson said from beside me. I heard him speak, but not the words. The island had me. The watchful jungles and threatening peaks reminded me of the penny dreadful tales that fascinated me as a child. In those, all manner of objects seemed to exude evil in the same way a man sweats. And at the time, no better means of description came to mind. Trovar sweated evil. "Come now, Felix. I know you too well. It's no good feigning deafness this late in our friendship." Herb, a leather-skinned fellow with an amiable grin, glanced around the ship as if he mistrusted the men around him. If you ignore me, I'll only have the English and natives to talk to. He spit over the railing. How dismal life would be. Indeed, I said, breaking the island's hold over me. I'd pity those poor souls who'd have to suffer through your tiresome accounts of misguided debauchery. Ah, the infamous King Wei wit. How sharp it is. Herb pulled a cigar from his shirt pocket and held it between ivory teeth without lighting it. The ladies tell me they dare not disrobe around you for fear of being cut by that wit. Liar, I proclaimed, smiling. You know, such postulation would require you actually speak to a woman, and as every man on this ship knows, your bladder would never allow such bravery. We chuckled and feigned disinterest in the island. Through the village on Gilbert Island, where our voyage originated, we'd heard legends of a dead island. It was said that it hid from those who knew not where to look, and those who knew where to look never returned to tell. The stories caught the attention of Paul Schmeck, a man known for specializing in the imports and exports of hard-to-find items. He had investigated the legend as best he could, but differing rumors made any real knowledge vague. Some said the human body melted the instant anyone set foot on its sands. Others claimed that plants came to life at night and dragged men into the earth, kicking and screaming, where they were digested over millennia. I myself heard a drunken native telling of an evil so consuming it drove men mad by the mere sight of it. Schmeck became enthralled by the idea of finding the island. He came to Herb and I and asked for our assistance. We had worked for him in the past, and he valued our rare brand of discretion. The conversation was lengthy, but in the end, he enticed us with promises of posterity. He reasoned that since the island appeared on no map and no records existed, we could name every mountain peak, river, beach, and stream. Our names would piggyback eternity with the likes of Cook or Columbus. And for a sea tramp like me, who's never owned his own horse or commanded a ship or saved a cent of what I earned, the prospect of fame came on like a hunger. Real or not, I seized the opportunity. Now, with the island standing testament, I believed every one of those stories. Notwithstanding their uncanny nature, every grotesque detail became fact in my mind. Schmeck lumbered toward us. His limp caused him to stumble as the ship keeled with the course change. He struggled to keep his hefty torso from dragging him to the deck, and composed himself before continuing. "Sirs," he said, gripping the rail with both hands. Herb smiled. "Quite the sea legs you've got." "Yes, well, I couldn't appear any queerer than the two of you at the moment. I've only seen such grim expressions on battered women. Haven't we found what we came for? Haven't we accomplished something of merit? Break out the bottle I know you smuggled aboard, for Christ's sake, and let's celebrate." Herb patted his back pocket where he kept his flask. "No bottle, just a personal serving today." "A shame. We'll need more sauce than that to ease our thirst tonight. From the looks of the westerly skies, I'd say we'll be spending the night on that rock." "Impossible," I said. "We were to make landfall, survey the area, christen a few streams and bays, and depart. You mentioned nothing about spending a length of time on Trovar." "Come now," Schmeck said with irritating pleasantness and an unwavering grin. "We need to map the island, gather samples, take notes." "Take notes? Map the island? That will take weeks, if not months." "Don't be childish, Felix. The gap for exploration is closing. Almost every reach of our planet has been trampled by man's heel, and here we face one of the final specks of unexplored land remaining. Think of Lewis and Clark, or Hudson. Think of the legacy." I began to protest, but he raised a palm. "Now that we've found the island, I fully intend to reimburse you for your troubles. How would £300 each sound?" Instead of waiting for a reply, he pivoted awkwardly and yelled for the captain to prepare a landing. This isn't done, I said over the commotion. Schmeck gave a dismissive wave. A storm conquered the sky, and men scurried beneath it across the deck like frenzied ants, checking sails and riggings. Herb and I turned back to the sea, back to Trovar. We were closer, close enough to smell the humidity and hate wafting from the jungle, close enough to feel a pressure building in our chests. The idea of being watched and waited for crept back into my thoughts. The island wanted us. It needed us. And we went willingly.
Resh and his son watched from the tallest tree as a small ship broke free from the cloud barrier that surrounded and masked Trovar. The clouds floated on the water and never moved or shifted, and lay so thick that most any traveler with sense invariably avoided them. Those who didn't fell prey to Trovar's children. His eyes narrowed as the ship grew near, approaching the village side of the island. He counted at least a score of men on board. He motioned to runners who waited on the jungle floor, and they sprinted off to spread his orders. Within minutes, every flame on the island was extinguished, and every one of Trovar's children was in place. Resh shut his eyes and spoke aloud to his son in a language that was harsh, laborious, and older than the trees, or the sky, or the waters.
It will not be long. Soon the moonskins will arrive to steal what is ours. Moonskins, always more dangerous than the time before. Always more of Trovar's children die. But Resh grows more dangerous, too. Resh learns from mistakes. Watch. Learn. Trovar not happy when his children die. So we must be stronger. And smarter. Trovar demands it.
His eyes snapped open, and he ran a red tongue over cracked lips.
Tonight we offer Trovar a bone sacrifice. Tomorrow, Trovar will smile on us.
Resh locked with his son's obedient eyes, and hefted a scepter made of bone that represented Trovar's power.
One day, Trovar will choose you to replace me. On that day, you must be ready to ensure wayward souls don't spoil this land.
Resh's son nodded with the cold dispassion of a warrior. They remained in the tree until the vessel stopped in Trovar's sacred bay, and the men aboard split into smaller ships.
The rain comes. Good. Better for hunting.
We dropped anchor in an emerald cove lined with black beaches. My stomach churned as our raft splashed down, and something hidden within me urged me to dive in the water and swim away, swim fast and far, never looking back, never slowing down. But something else, something wiser, told me that there wasn't enough distance in the world to save me from Trovar. The island had seen me, and no matter where I went, it would always see me. I looked to Herb, but his face was masked by his silver flask. When he was done, a ruddy face appeared. "What say you?" he asked. "My appreciation for Schmeck is fading."
"I've tossed that old fool," he burst. The liquor had set in. "We simply keep our heads down for the time being. Then we can take some time in Australia, or those Hawaiian islands the government mules are always neighing about. With 300 pounds, we could even find us some top-shelf women, and not those wash basins we get back on Gilbert, either. So toss Schmeck. Toss him right to the sharks."
"I still don't like it. A man should have a choice in what he does."
"I don't know about you," he said as he began to row, "but I choose to bury my face in the bosom of a Hawaiian woman."
The wind gusted in strong bursts as we approached the shore. We unloaded our provisions and set about searching for a place to make camp. A few feet into the jungle, we discovered a clearing. The sands from the beach extended there, creating a soft, ebony floor. Schmeck declared the spot perfect and gave the order to settle in. The crew was split into two groups, the first to pitch tents, build fires, and prepare meals, while the second explored the surrounding area for sources of water and any landmarks of note. Herb and I ignored Schmeck's orders and focused our attention on security. From what? We did not know. Due to the bizarre stories of the island, Schmeck had brought a rifle for each man, oiled and clean, a pair of dueling revolvers, and enough ammunition to put a hole in every leaf on the island. Herb discovered a crate containing a longbore rifle with a dark wood finish. He inspected the sights, the muzzle, and grunted his approval. "Any experience with guns?" he asked. "A bit. Somewhere between Pennsylvania and California, I worked for a cornhusker who paid a half cent for every crow I shot. But the deal ended when he said my poor aim cost more in bullets than it was worth." "I guess I'll take this, slender lady, then. Gun like this deserves a keen eye." "No argument there. I'll do fine with a repeater." I scanned the jungle. We were losing sight, and soon the green walls would become enigmas in the dark. Dusk cold breath filled my body. Herb opened the mahogany box containing the revolvers and handed me one. "In case the rumors prove true," he said, while shoving the second gun into the back of his pants. The night came on fast and thick. A gift from Trova. Four children, each covered in black mud, crept into the canopy where Resh waited. The tallest child, a girl with fine bones sewn into her hair, and no real trace of adolescence other than her size, reported that the moonskins were in the clearing. Yes, the same clearing as always. Resh smiled. The moonskins were predictable. There were 23 men. They were scared, but they also had weapons. Yes, the kind that fire smoke and metal. Resh pondered the report. He had watched the bigger ship ever since a smaller one separated from it. In that time, he hadn't seen any movement on board. But the moonskins never leave the big ship unattended, so he assumed they were hiding. He'd have to send his best swimmers to handle them. A stone-faced man approached. His skin was also covered in black mud. All that separated him from the night was the whites of his eyes and the sharpened length of bone he carried. "Resh," he said, and kneeled.
"Trova's children ready,"
Resh replied in a voice that scratched the air. "Yes."
"Good. Strike when the sky weeps. Trova only requires four. Kill the rest."
The man stood, turned, and exited, quickly melding into the shadows. Resh bent by a stream and scooped mud into a large mound. Then he dumped black sand from a pouch onto the mud, kneaded until the mixture became a thick paste, and applied it to his skin. He clicked his tongue, and a woman approached with her eyes to the ground, holding his communing ornaments. She helped him dress, and when she was done, Resh proceeded to the altar. He had much to prepare for Trovar's offering. Our camp consisted of 3 fires, 11 tents, 23 souls, and 46 watchful eyes. On the surface, our mood was light and jovial. The sailors told stories of past employment and discussed which captains were fair and which trading companies paid the best. They were Dutch and English and American and Islander. And although they laughed together, not one left their rifle more than a few feet away. I sat with Herb near the biggest fire, and we talked of our lives. A man born from Poseidon's own lineage, rough and humble, Herb lived a nomadic life, skipping from one South Seas rock to another. As he spoke of the world, one got the sense that beneath his carefree mannerisms hid a man who understood the world around him on an intimate level. and as he discussed the varied peoples of his travels, his voice became smooth and wise, coaxing my fears away. Schmeck waddled over and sat across from us. The storm had wiped the smirk off his face, revealing a rawness one rarely saw in the stubborn man.
"Good evening," he said, humbled. "Before we get off to Bickery, let me express my gratitude for your general acceptance of the situation. I made assumptions concerning your involvement, and I deserve nothing less than to have the two of you tie me to the anchor. I apologize."
I studied him for a long while, and knew him for the shrewd negotiator that he was. His apology was a ruse. If making money required a heart of gold, Schmeck would cast his in 24 carats. But the second that heart lost its utility, you'd find him smelting it for profit. "That's not a bad idea," I finally said.
"What?"
"Tying you to the anchor." We chuckled and the air lightened. "So, when are we doing this note-taking?" I asked.
"Don't forget the sample gathering and map-making," Herb added.
"First light, I hope you gents have some proper names in mind, because I expect to fill the map with our legacies. Think of all the times you've carved your initials in decking. How many ships brandished the name Felix in some secret location? We, my fine friends, are doing just that, but on a much grander scale. Also, keep an eye for local flora and fauna. Imagine if we returned with a black tiger or a slower-burning tobacco."
Herb perked. "Folks statewide would shell out a week's pay for a look at a black tiger."
"My thoughts exactly, Mr. Flenderson."
"You know," Herb said, "I think I might remember bringing a bottle along after all."
"Really?" Schmeck asked.
"Perhaps. Let me..." A scream in the distance cut him off, followed by three quick rifle shots. The camp collectively froze, then roared to life. Men grabbed rifles, taking sight at the tree line. Others shouted orders. Two more shots rang out, followed by a gangly man running into the camp. Flecks of blood covered half his face. We ran to him.
"Drew, who's shooting?" Schmeck yelled.
The man, Drew, appeared bewildered. His lips moved without word.
"Drew, say something, man!"
Drew broke from the daze.
"I saw him," he said in a cracking voice. "Four of them."
"Who?"
Skeletons.
Drew whispered the word as if he were cursing in church.
"Me and Falk was out patrolling when we came across them. They stood in the distance watching us. Their bones cleaved the dark clear as day, but they didn't move. We figured they were made up that way, you know, just old sets of bones that someone stood up instead of burying. When we got closer, the four of them took a step toward us like they was attached at the hip. I know it sounds crazy, but I swear it. The sight hit us something awful. The four skeletons never made another move. They just stared without eyes. I fired, but they didn't even flinch. Why would they? They got nothing to shoot. Nothing. And then I heard folks screaming. I looked over and this black figure was on him, ripping him to shreds right there next to me. Oh, God. Blood."
He looked around the camp, and we saw the truth in his face.
It was like his own shadow had come to life and started killing him.
Panic ripped through the collected men.
"Let's return to the ship," one man said,
and soon everyone was in agreement. Everyone, except Schmeck.
"No, the thought of bones walking about is preposterous. And demon shadows? Where's your marrow? I refuse to cow to such fantasy."
Just then, the laden clouds decided to release their burden, and fat, warm drops of rain fell. The fire singed and drowned. Commotion broke out and shouts erupted behind us. Small black demons, maybe 10, maybe 50 in total, slithered from the dark in all directions. They moved like blurs. Shots rang out, followed by shouts for assistance, then shouts of terror, then pain, agonizing pain. My mind clouded with indecision. I couldn't process the chaos. I watched as two sailors fired into the thicket. A child-sized demon ran up behind them and struck the backs of their knees.
Thin lines of blood sprayed, and both men crumpled backwards. With a fluid motion, the demon was at their throats. The two men kicked and convulsed in the mud next to each other, and the demon quickly moved on. Drew's high-pitched screams caught my attention. Ivory's skeleton stood among the trees, watching. Drew raised his rifle and fired twice before the gun clicked dry. He dropped the useless weapon and fled toward the beach. Schmeck followed, his limp pronounced by fear, but stopped when faced with more of the ghastly skeletons, cutting off his retreat. I found the courage to act when Herb's rifle exploded with a plume of white smoke. One of the skeletons dropped away. In reaction, the encircling line began to move. They cinched in closer, holding a perfect band around the clearing as demons darted among us. We were routed. Men were dead or dying, and those who weren't were in wild disarray. Schmeck bellowed inanely for everyone to rally around him, but those who stood wouldn't for long. Already the desperate cries outweighed the gunfire. Herb fired again, hitting a skeleton next to the first one he had shot, and aimed at the next. He was creating a gap. I tried to help, but my shots went wide. I didn't know where to aim. At the bone? The head? The heart? Do they have hearts? For that matter, would they even stay down if hit? When it came time to reload, Herb grabbed my shirt and yanked. We made for the gap. As we punched through the undergrowth, Schmeck's voice rose behind us like a terrible wind. I had no concept of direction as we ran, but I sensed we had set ourselves inland. We tore through all manner of brambles until we came upon a mass of broad-leaved vines and hid. My chest burned. We could no longer smell the sea or hear the brutalized screams. Struggling to control my breath, I listened for followers and heard only the soothing patter of rain on plant. Everything was happening too rapidly. I couldn't move or think. I needed to reload, but couldn't find the will to do so. Herb spoke, but I couldn't understand the words. They were foreign and odd. He pointed toward the camp, toward the slaughter. I looked, comprehending on a primal level that he needed me to aim my weapon in that direction. I wanted to tell him that I couldn't, but he was already firing. My name penetrated Herb's incoherent words. Felix! Dozens of dark souls scurried forth, spread across the entirety of my vision. They leapt over deadfalls and passed through wilderness with ease. Herb cursed when his gun jammed. He howled, raised the rifle over his head, and greeted the onslaught. As they descended on him with white clubs and red rage, I noticed the black on several of the demons melting in the rain. Beneath was flesh. The inhuman was human. My mind made connections as it was previously incapable of making. I yanked the dueling pistol from the back of my trousers and pulled the trigger. Red splash as one body spun with contact. I kneeled for better accuracy, emboldened, and fired again. A black demon spewed blood from its chest, but the swarm came on. I had time for two more shots before I was forced to swing the pistol like a hammer. I connected, but the impact slowed my next swing, and then they were on me, clawing, punching, biting. I saw a cold dispassion in their young faces, and not the savageness I had expected. They were calm in their brutality. And then I saw no more.
Trova, happy,
Resh declared to the congregated tribe. He stood on the stone altar, gazing over them with pride. A few of Trovar's children were lost, but only half as many as the last time. Resh attributed this to Trovar's gift of rain. And now that the tribe had gathered and the offerings were ready, Resh would ensure that Trovar gave them many more gifts in the time to come.
The moon skins are defeated. Now we offer Trovar their bones.
His son had perished in the battle. But Resh did not mourn his young one. Trovar had a plan and would provide. The death had purpose, as did all things
on the island. I awoke to fire crackling and a sinister, well-practiced murmuring that reminded me of chanting monks. I moved to my knees, but a powerful force pushed me back to the ground. A sharp pain spiked my arm as I fell sideways, and I realized that my hands were bound behind me. I twisted to face my oppressor. A skeleton towered there, silent. Eyes glimmered from within the sockets of the skull, and I remembered seeing flesh on the demons. Human flesh. I saw these monstrosities with new eyes. What I saw wasn't a skeleton at all, but a costume. The bones lacked depth. The ribs curved inward as they should, but didn't circle around to a spine. Nor did the skull completely enclose. My eyes focused on the dark areas between the white frame, and I noticed dark mud concealing the man beneath. The man dressed as a skeleton was but one of many that circled a large pit, dug from the side of the Black Mountain. Across from me was a polished stone altar. The demon children kneeled before it with their heads bowed in obedient order, mimicking glazed statues in the orange firelight. The evil chanting came from atop the altar, where a man dressed in an ornate version of a human skeleton stood. He wore a full skull, split at the sides and widened, like a helmet. A spine, polished white, curved with his back, from which a fan of longer bones, possibly human femurs, protruded in parody of a long-deceased peacock. The bone man raised his hands over his head, and I noticed Drew's slender figure lying on a slab beneath him. The chant quickened, becoming more of a yell than a prayer. Anxiety overwhelmed me as the bone man swept his hands back and forth. Drew lay still for a moment, but his body suddenly arched, fighting against the restraints binding his arms and legs. He writhed and flexed, but through some power not his own. As the chanting grew in intensity, so did Drew's struggle. Soon he was screaming. The bone man continued to wave his hands. A crack sounded through the gruesome words. Then a whole succession of cracks, like a forest worth of trees snapping in half all at once. Drew wailed with purgatorial agony, and I could see his skin shift with inner movement, his flesh bending in grotesque bubbles as his own skeleton tried to force its way free from his body. More cracking sounds. More screams. Ribs expanded within his chest. An elbow exploded, revealing the rounded ends of his joint. Toes separated from their feet. Collarbones buckled and folded upward. The scream tapered into a gurgle. The bone man started jerking his arms in an upward motion, as if ushering Drew's bones forth. Drew continued to arch away from the altar, mutilated, lifeless. With a sickening tear, his rib cage began to surface through his skin. The other elbow exploded, followed by both knees, and red pulp rained in a cloudy mist. I shut my eyes, squeezed them tight, and prayed they never opened again. But I couldn't shut my ears. I listened as his body was shredded. Tissue and bone conspired to form a squishing, ripping. I heaved. When my eyes fluttered open, the bone man stood holding a red skull in one hand and a polished scepter that radiated religious significance in the other. Various bloodied bones were being shared among the children, and before the bone man lay the red gore that remained of Drew, and behind his skeletal mask, an imagined sneer. The bone man stepped down from the altar. His stride was long. Each step brought him unbearably closer. Someone whimpered, and I became aware of a quaking presence. I craned my neck,
Herb and Schmeck lay in similar positions. Schmeck's face shone with tears. Herb gave a slight nod. As the bone man approached, all others watched. He stopped within arm's length, raised his scepter, and pointed. My heart shriveled. The end of his scepter had a crude etching of a man's face, bearded and primitive. I saw this because the image was pointed directly at me. The bone man didn't need to speak. Powerful hands grabbed my arms and yanked me to my feet. My legs tried to fold but failed under my captor's hold. The bonds on my hands were cut. I tried to thrash free, but a blow to the back of my head extinguished any fight. No, Herb bellowed. You sons of bitches, let him be. Hundreds of tribesmen looked on with blank detachment. Orange streaks from the firelight trailed across my vision. I tried to focus, but the ground pulled away as I was lifted to my feet. You sons of bitches, I said no. I was dropped. I crumpled to the ground in a daze. Running feet pounded on the ground, surprise exclamations. A skeleton crashed beside me, bones clattering. I lifted my head to see what had happened. Herb was pinned to the ground a few feet from the bone man. Herb had tried to fight them, tried to save me. The bone man pointed his scepter at Herb and spoke a single line. Impossibly, Herb's forearm twisted clockwise until it met resistance. Then a snap. Herb wailed and tried to cover his broken and still twisting arm. I looked around, the streaks of firelight a permanent part of my vision now. Schmeck was wrapped into a fetal ball. The children, those emotionless shadows, gathered around. I watched as the bone man magically broke Herb's other arm, and a feral instinct ignited in me. I stood with an effort. The men around me were too enthralled in the torture to notice. Some of the skeletons with a wider view must have seen, but they were too far to react. I staggered, then lunged forward in a desperate grab for the bone man. I had no plan. I only understood the need to stop him. One hand found the fan of bones at his back, and the other found his outreached scepter. I pulled on both, separating the two. I continued to pull him backward, and in a blind fury, I brought the scepter down on his face in pulverizing swings. His mask shattered, driving shards of bone into his eyes. I loosed the beast within. All my fear, disgust, and hate powered my strikes, each landing with more viciousness than the last. I couldn't, wouldn't stop. When he toppled to the ground, I followed by straddling his chest. I raised the scepter over my head, hot blood streaking my face, and prepared for a final strike. I froze. The children stood inches from me in a tight pack. They didn't move, nor did the skeletons behind them, and, for once, there was emotion in their faces. Awe. Schmeck fled as best he could. No one tried to stop him. He stumbled over a black mound of dirt and vanished. The indifference set a cold chill through my body. Why weren't they reacting? Why weren't they swarming? And for a moment, the world seemed to freeze, and only I could move. A powerful presence consumed me, burning at first, but then soothing as its influence spread throughout. I could suddenly sense all life around me. It was as if I was looking at a map of the island, with every single organism marked with a red dot. I had knowledge of every bird, beetle,
and man that made contact with Trovar. More than that, I held a connection with all life, both present and ancient. In my mind's eye, I could see the tribesmen's eyes. But they weren't tribesmen. They were Trovar's children, my brothers and sisters. I looked into Resh's life and knew his history. He had been the tribe's longest-lasting voice of Trovar. But now, it was my time. Trovar had chosen me. I held the scepter, a remnant of Trovar's physical body long destroyed, and with it, Trovar's power. I looked at the scepter in my hand, and reality came crashing back. Erb moaned on the ground. The fire crackled. The clouds let out a weak rumble of a storm that had moved on. And a primeval voice whispered in my ear. Three of Trovar's children helped Erb to his feet. He looked at me with worry and wonder. The tribe watched, waiting for direction. "We take care of you," I said, in harsh words that were older than the trees or the sky or the waters. "Felix, promise." The worry stayed with Erb, but he would understand with time. If Trovar let him heal, then he would be allowed to assimilate with the tribe, become one of Trovar's children. I climbed the steps to the altar, stood erect in front of my people, and spoke. "One still lives. The fat one. Bring him. His thick bones will please Trovar." A flood of Trovar's children lurched into the jungle in search of Shmek. "He won't escape, for I am the voice of Trovar. I am Felix, and I have been chosen to ensure wayward souls don't spoil this land."
That was The Island Trovar by J.C. Hemphill, narrated by Adam Pratch. While quite a few of our stories have horror elements, this one might be the goriest we've run. Pulp tales, particularly those of the Lovecraft school, tend mostly towards psychological horror, but this one is a lot more direct. If you thought it was too gory or would like warnings for this kind of content, please let us know. This narration also ties into a discussion we had recently on the forum regarding production. As with his previous contribution, Adam added some effects to his performance this time that I think really helped bring the tale to life, but to what extent future narrations are tweaked this way is still a very open question. We'd love to hear your opinion on both these topics. Tell us in the comments of our site at protectingprojectpulp.com, or join the conversation in the District of Wonders forum, linked from the site. And while you're there, don't forget to subscribe to the show via iTunes or your podcast app of choice. Just click the subscribe link. Incidentally, this story calls to mind a poem that appeared in Weird Tales alongside our recent story, The Opener of the Way, and so I thought I'd include it here. This is The Temples of Xantus by Howell Calhoun. Celestial fantasies of deathless night, enraptured colonnades adorned with pearls, resplendent guardians of crimson light, expansive darkness silently unfurls. Among colossal ruins on this shore, that once was pearled by Xantus' rolling seas, nothing remains upon this barren core of Mars but your palatial memories. Your altars and magnificent black gods still flash beneath the sapphire torch's flames. The fragrant ring of sacred flowers nods beneath the monstrous idol's gilded frames. Your jeweled gates swing open on their bands of gold within a lurid shadow stands. Thanks for listening from everyone here at PPP. Our assistant editor, Fred Heimbaugh, our sound engineer, Tom O'Dwyer, our producer, Tony C. Smith, and from me, your host, Simon Hildebrand. We hope you'll join us next time for episode 66, where we'll bring you War Plans Divided by Robert Leslie Bellum. Always remember that thick bones please Trevor, and have a great week.
This presentation has been brought to you by the District of Wonders Network, dedicated to podcasting the finest genre fiction. You can learn more about the District of Wonders and their many literary productions at their website, www.districtofwonders.com. Thank you for listening.